Churn said, putting it into the boy's hand. Through the crib window, Mrs. McEachern came into view, emerging from the house. She now wore a faded Mother Hubbard and a sunbonnet, and she carried a cedar bucket. She crossed the window without looking toward the crib and vanished. After a time, the slow creak of a well pulley reached them, coming with a peaceful, startling quality upon the Sabbath air. Then she appeared again in the window, her body balanced now to the bucket's weight in her hand, and re-entered the house without looking toward the stable. Again on the dot of the hour, McEachern looked up from the watch. "Have you learned it?" he said. The boy did not answer, did not move. When McEachern approached, he saw that the boy was not looking at the page at all, that his eyes were quite fixed and quite blank. When he put his hand on the book, he found that the boy was clinging to it as if it were a rope or a post. When McEachern took the book forcibly from his hands, the boy fell at full length to the floor and did not move again. When he came to, it was late afternoon. He was in his own bed in the attic room with its low-pitched roof. The room was quiet, already filling with twilight. He felt quite well, and he lay for some time, looking peacefully up at the slanted ceiling overhead, before he became aware that there was someone sitting beside the bed. It was McEachern. He now wore his everyday clothes also. Not the overalls in which he went to the field, but a faded clean shirt without a collar, and faded clean khaki trousers. "You are awake," he said. His hand came forth and turned back the cover. "Come," he said. The boy did not move. "Are you going to whip me again?" "Come," McEachern said. "Get up." The boy rose from the bed and stood, thin, in clumsy cotton underclothes. McEachern was moving also, thickly, with clumsy, muscle-bound movements, as if at the expenditure of tremendous effort. The boy, watching with the amazeless interest of a child, saw the man kneel slowly and heavily beside the bed. "Kneel down," McEachern said. The boy knelt. The two of them knelt in the close, twilight room. The small figure in cut-down underwear, the ruthless man who had never known either pity or doubt. McEachern began to pray. He prayed for a long time, his voice droning, soporific, monotonous. He asked that he be forgiven for trespass against the Sabbath and for lifting his hand against a child, an orphan, who was dear to God. He asked that the child's stubborn heart be softened and that the sin of disobedience be forgiven him also, through the advocacy of the man whom he had flouted and disobeyed, requesting that Almighty be as magnanimous as himself, and by and through and because of conscious grace. He finished and rose, heaving to his feet. The boy still knelt. He did not move at all. But his eyes were open. His face had never been hidden or even lowered, and his face was quite calm. Calm, peaceful, quite inscrutable. He heard the man fumble at the table on which the lamp sat. A match scraped, spurted. The flame steadied upon the wick, beneath the globe upon which the man's hand appeared now as if it had been dipped in blood. The shadows whirled and steadied. McEachern lifted something from the table beside the lamp. The catechism. He looked down at the boy. A nose, a cheek jutting, granite-like, bearded to the caverned and spectacled eye socket. "Take the book," he said. It had begun that Sunday morning before breakfast. He had had no breakfast. Likely neither he nor the man had once thought of that. The man himself had eaten no breakfast, though he had gone to the table and demanded absolution for the food and for the necessity of eating it. At the noon meal he had been asleep, from nervous exhaustion. And at supper time neither of them had thought of food. The boy did not even know what was wrong with him, why he felt weak and peaceful. That was how he felt as he lay in bed. The lamp was still burning. It was now full dark outside. Some time had elapsed, but it seemed to him that if he turned his head, he would still see the two of them, himself and the man, kneeling beside the bed. Or anyway, in the rug, the indentations of the twin pairs of knees without tangible substance. Even the air seemed still to excrete that monotonous voice as of someone talking in a dream. Talking, adjuring, arguing with a presence who could not even make a phantom indentation in an actual rug. He was lying so on his back, his hands crossed on his breast like a tomb effigy, when he heard again feet on the cramped stairs. They were not the man's. He had heard McEachern drive away in the buggy, departing in the twilight to drive 3 miles and to a church which was not Presbyterian, to serve the expiation which he had set himself for the morning. Without turning his head, the boy heard Mrs. McEachern toil slowly up the stairs. He heard her approach across the floor. He did not look, though after a time her shadow came and fell upon the wall where he could see it, and he saw that she was carrying something. It was a tray of food. She set the tray on the bed. He had not once looked at her. He had not moved. "Joe," she said. He didn't move. "Joe," she said. She could see that his eyes were open. She did not touch him. "I ain't hungry," he said. She didn't move. She stood, her hands folded into her apron. She didn't seem to be looking at him either. She seemed to be speaking to the wall beyond the bed. "I know what you think. It ain't that. He never told me to bring it to you. It was me that thought to do it. He don't know. It ain't any food he sent you." He didn't move. His face was calm as a graven face, looking up at the steep pitch of the plank ceiling. "You haven't eaten today. Sit up and eat. It wasn't him that told me to bring it to you. He don't know it. I waited until he was gone, and then I fixed it myself." He sat up then. While she watched him, he rose from the bed and took the tray and carried it to the corner and turned it upside down, dumping the dishes and food and all onto the floor. Then he returned to the bed, carrying the empty tray like it was a monstrance, and he, the bearer, his surplice, the cut-down undergarment which had been bought for a man to wear. She was not watching him now, though she had not moved. Her hands were still rolled into her apron. He got back into bed and lay again on his back, his eyes wide and still upon the ceiling. He could see her motionless shadow, shapeless, a little hunched. Then it went away. He did not look, but he could hear her kneel in the corner, gathering the broken dishes back into the tray. Then she left the room. It was quite still then. The lamp burned steadily above the steady wick. On the wall, the flitting shadows of whirling moths were as large as birds. From beyond the window, he could smell, feel, darkness, spring, the earth. He was just 8 then. It was years later that memory knew what he was remembering. Years after that night when, an hour later, he rose from the bed and went and knelt in the corner as he had not knelt on the rug and above the outraged food kneeling with his hands 8, like a savage, like a dog. It was dusk. Already he should have been miles toward home. Although his Saturday afternoons were free, he had never before been this far from home this late. When he reached home, he would be whipped, but not for what he might have or might not have done during his absence. When he reached home, he would receive the same whipping, though he had committed no sin, as he would receive if McEachern had seen him commit it. but perhaps he did not yet know himself that he was not going to commit the sin. The five of them were gathered quietly in the dusk about the sagging doorway of a deserted sawmill shed where, waiting hidden 100 yards away, they had watched the Negro girl enter and look back once and then vanish. One of the older boys had arranged it, and he went in first. The others, boys in identical overalls, who lived within a 3-mile radius, who, like the one whom they knew as Joe McEachern, could at 14 and 15 plow and milk and chop wood like grown men, drew straws for turns. Perhaps he did not even think of it as a sin until he thought of the man who would be waiting for him at home, since to 14 the paramount sin would be to be publicly convicted of virginity. His turn came. He entered the shed. It was dark. At once he was overcome by a terrible haste. There was something in him trying to get out, like when he had used to think of toothpaste. But he could not move at once, standing there, smelling the woman, smelling the Negro all at once. Enclosed by the woman, she Negro, and the haste, driven, having to wait until she spoke. A guiding sound that was no particular word and completely unaware. Then it seemed to him that he could see her. Something, prone, abject. Her eyes, perhaps. Leaning, he seemed to look down into a black well, and at the bottom saw two glints like reflections of dead stars. He was moving, because his foot touched her. Then it touched her again because he kicked her. He kicked her hard, kicking into and through a choked wail of surprise and fear. She began to scream, he jerking her up, clutching her by the arm, hitting at her with wide, wild blows, striking at the voice, perhaps, feeling her flesh anyway, enclosed by the woman she Negro and the haste. Then she fled beneath his fist, and he too fled backward as the others fell upon him, swarming, grappling, fumbling, he striking back, his breath hissing with rage and despair. Then it was male he smelled, they smelled. Somewhere beneath it the she scuttling, screaming. They trampled and swayed, striking at whatever hand or body touched, until they all went down in a mass, he underneath. Yet he still struggled, fighting, weeping. There was no she at all now. They just fought. It was as if a wind had blown among them, hard and clean. They held him down now, holding him helpless. "Will you quit now? We got you. Promise to quit now." "No," he said. He heaved, twisting. "Quit, Joe? You can't fight all of us. Don't nobody want to fight you anyway." "No," he said, panting, struggling. None of them could see, tell who was who. They had completely forgot about the girl, why they had fought, if they had ever known. On the part of the other four, it had been purely automatic and reflex. That spontaneous compulsion of the male to fight with or because of or over the partner with which he has recently or is about to copulate. But none of them knew why he had fought. And he could not have told them. They held him to the earth, talking to one another in quiet, strained voices. "Some of you all back there get away. Then the rest of us will turn him loose at the same time. Who's got him? Who is this I've got? Here, turn loose. Now wait. Here he is. Me and..." Again the mass of them surged, struggled. They held him again. "We got him here. You all turn loose and get out. Give us room." Two of them rose and backed away into the door. Then the other two seemed to explode upward out of the earth, the dusk-filled shed already running. Joe struck at them as soon as he was free, but they were already clear. Lying on his back, he watched the four of them run on in the dusk, slowing, turning to look back. He rose and emerged from the shed. He stood in the door, brushing himself off, this too purely automatic, while a short distance away they huddled quietly and looked back at him. He did not look at them. He went on, his overalls dusk-colored in the dusk. It was late now. The evening star was rich and heavy as a jasmine bloom. He did not look back once. He went on, fading, phantom-like. The four boys who watched him huddled quietly, their faces small and pale with dusk. From the group, a voice spoke suddenly, loud. "Yeah!" He did not look back. A second voice said quietly, carrying quietly, clear, "See you tomorrow at church, Joe." He didn't answer. He went on. Now and then he brushed at his overalls, mechanically, with his hands. When he came in sight of home, all light had departed from the west. In the pasture behind the barn there was a spring. A clump of willows in the darkness, smelt and heard but not seen. When he approached, the fluting of young frogs ceased like so many strings cut with simultaneous scissors. He knelt. It was too dark to discern even his silhouetted head. He bathed his face, his swollen eye. He went on, crossing the pasture toward the kitchen light. It seemed to watch him, biting and threatful, like an eye. When he reached the lot fence, he stopped, looking at the light in the kitchen window. He stood there for a while, leaning on the fence. The grass was aloud, alive with crickets. Against the dew-gray earth and the dark bands of trees, fireflies drifted and faded, erratic and random. A mockingbird sang in a tree beside the house. Behind him, in the woods beyond the spring, two whippoorwills whistled. Beyond them, as though beyond some ultimate horizon of summer, a hound howled. Then he crossed the fence and saw someone sitting quite motionless in the door to the stable in which waited the two cows, which he had not yet milked. He seemed to recognize McEachern without surprise, as if the whole situation were perfectly logical and reasonable and inescapable. Perhaps he was thinking then how he and the man could always count upon one another, depend upon one another, that it was the woman alone who was unpredictable. Perhaps he saw no incongruity at all in the fact that he was about to be punished, who had refrained from what McEachern would consider the cardinal sin which he could commit, exactly the same as if he had committed it. McEachern did not rise. He still sat, stolid and rock-like, his shirt a white blur in the door's black yawn. "I have milked and fed," he said. Then he rose deliberately. Perhaps the boy knew that he already held the strap in his hand. It rose and fell, deliberate, numbered, with deliberate, flat reports. The boy's body might have been wood or stone, a post or a tower upon which the sentient part of him mused like a hermit, contemplative and remote with ecstasy and self-crucifixion. As they approached the kitchen, they walked side by side. When the light from the window fell upon them, the man stopped and turned, leaning, peering. "Fighting," he said. "What was it about?" The boy did not answer. His face was quite still, composed. After a while, he answered. His voice was quiet, cold. "Nothing." They stood there.
"You mean you can't tell or you won't tell?"
The boy did not answer. He was not looking down. He was not looking at anything.
"Then if you don't know, you are a fool. And if you won't tell, you have been a knave. Have you been to a woman?"
"No," the boy said. The man looked at him. When he spoke, his tone was musing.
"You have never lied to me. That I know of, that is."
He looked at the boy, at the still profile.
"Who were you fighting with?"
"There was more than one."
"Ah," the man said. "You left marks on them, I trust?"
"I don't know." I reckon so.
Ah, the man said. Go and wash. Supper is ready.
When he went to bed that night, his mind was made up to run away. He felt like an eagle, hard, sufficient, potent, remorseless, strong.
But that passed, though he did not then know that, like the eagle, his own flesh, as well as all space, was still a cage.
McEachern did not actually miss the heifer for 2 days. Then he found the new suit where it was hidden in the barn. On examining it, he knew that it had never been worn. He found the suit in the forenoon, but he said nothing about it. That evening, he entered the barn where Joe was milking. Sitting on the low stool, his head bent against the cow's flank, the boy's body was now by height at least the body of a man. But McEachern did not see that. If he saw anything at all, it was the child, the orphan of 5 years who had sat with the still and alert and unrecking passiveness of an animal on the seat of his buggy on that December evening 12 years ago.
I don't see your heifer, McEachern said.
Joe didn't answer. He bent above the bucket, above the steady hissing of milk. McEachern stood behind and above him, looking down at him.
I said, your heifer has not come up.
I know it, Joe said. I reckon she is down at the creek. I'll look after her, being as she belongs to me.
Ah, McEachern said. His voice was not raised. The creek at night is no place for a $50 cow.
It'll be my loss then, Joe said. It was my cow.
Was, McEachern said. Did you say was my cow?
Joe did not look up. Between his fingers the milk hissed steadily into the pail. Behind him he heard McEachern move. But Joe did not look around until the milk no longer responded. Then he turned. McEachern was sitting on a wooden block in the door.
You had better take the milk on to the house first, he said.
Joe stood, the pail swinging from his hand. His voice was dogged, though quiet.
I'll find her in the morning.
Take the milk on to the house, McEachern said.
I will wait for you here.
For a moment longer, Joe stood there. Then he moved. He emerged and went on to the kitchen. Mrs. McEachern came in as he was setting the pail onto the table. Supper is ready, she said. Has Mr. McEachern come to the house yet? Joe was turning away, back toward the door. He'll be in soon, he said. He could feel the woman watching him. She said, in a tone tentative, anxious, you'll have just time to wash. We'll be in soon. He returned to the barn. Mrs. McEachern came to the door and looked after him. It was not yet full dark, and she could see her husband standing in the barn door. She did not call. She just stood there and watched the two men meet. She could not hear what they said.
She will be down at the creek, you say, McEachern said.
I said she may be. This is a good-sized pasture.
Ah, McEachern said.
Both their voices were quiet.
Where do you think she will be?
I don't know. I ain't no cow. I don't know where she might be.
McEachern moved. We'll go see, he said.
They entered the pasture in single file. The creek was a quarter of a mile distant. Against the dark band of trees where it flowed, fireflies winked and faded. They reached these trees. The trunks of them were choked with marshy undergrowth, hard to penetrate even by day. Call her, McEachern said. Joe did not answer. He did not move. They faced one another. She's my cow, Joe said. You gave her to me. I raised her from a calf because you gave her to me to be my own.
Yes, McEachern said. I gave her to you. To teach you the responsibility of possessing, owning, ownership. The responsibility of the owner to that which he owns under God's sufferance. To teach you foresight and aggrandizement. Call her. For a while longer they faced one another. Perhaps they were looking at one another. Then Joe turned and went on along the marsh, McEachern following. Why don't you call her? He said. Joe did not answer. He did not seem to be watching the marsh, the creek at all. On the contrary, he was watching the single light which marked the house, looking back now and then as if he were gauging his distance from it. They did not go fast, yet in time they came to the boundary fence which marked the end of the pasture. It was now full dark. When he reached the fence, Joe turned and stopped. Now he looked at the other. Again they stood face to face. Then McEachern said, What have you done with that heifer?
I sold her, Joe said.
Ah, you sold her. And what did you get for her, might I ask?
They could not distinguish one another's face now. They were just shapes, almost of a height, though McEachern was the thicker. Above the white blur of his shirt, McEachern's head resembled one of the marble cannonballs on Civil War monuments.
It was my cow, Joe said. If she wasn't mine, why did you tell me she was? Why did you give her to me?
You are quite right.
She was your own. I have not yet chidden you for selling her, provided you got a good price. And even if you were beat in the trade, which with a boy of 18 is more than like to be so, I will not chide you for that. Though you would better have asked the advice of someone older in the ways of the world. But you must learn, as I did. What I ask is, where have you put the money for safekeeping?
Joe didn't answer. They faced one another. You gave it to your foster mother to keep for you, belike?
Yes, Joe said.
His mouth said it, told the lie. He had not intended to answer at all. He heard his mouth say the word with a kind of shocked astonishment. Then it was too late.
I gave it to her to put away, he said.
Ah, McEachern said. He sighed. It was a sound almost luxurious, of satisfaction and victory. And you will doubtless say also that it was your foster mother who bought the new suit which I found hid in the loft. You have revealed every other sin of which you are capable, sloth, and ingratitude, and irreverence, and blasphemy. And now I have taken you in the remaining two, lying and lechery. What else would you want with a new suit if you were not whoring? And then he acknowledged that the child whom he had adopted 12 years ago was a man. Facing him, the two of them almost toe-to-toe, he struck at Joe with his fist. Joe took the first two blows, perhaps from habit, perhaps from surprise. But he took them, feeling twice the man's hard fist crash into his face. Then he sprang back, crouched, licking blood, panting. They faced one another.
"Don't you hit me again," he said.
Later, lying cold and rigid in his bed in the attic, he heard their voices coming up the cramped stairs from the room beneath.
"I bought it for him,"
Mrs. McEachern said.
"I did. I bought it with my butter money. You said that I could spend..." "Simon. Simon."
"You are a clumsier liar than even he," the man said. His voice came, measured, harsh, without heat,
up the cramped stair to where Joe lay in bed. He was not listening to it.
Kneel down. Kneel down. Kneel down, woman. Ask grace and pardon of God, not of me.
She had always tried to be kind to him, from that first December evening 12 years ago. She was waiting on the porch, a patient, beaten creature without sex demarcation at all, save the neat screw of graying hair and the skirt, when the buggy drove up. It was as though instead of having been subtly slain and corrupted by the ruthless and bigoted man into something beyond his intending and her knowing, she had been hammered stubbornly thinner and thinner like some passive and dully malleable metal into an attenuation of dumb hopes and frustrated desires, now faint and pale as dead ashes. When the buggy stopped, she came forward as though she had already planned it, practiced it. How she would lift him down from the seat and carry him into the house. He had never been carried by a woman since he was big enough to walk. He squirmed down and entered the house on his own feet, marched in, small, shapeless in his wrappings. She followed, hovering about him. She made him sit down. It was as though she hovered about with a kind of strained alertness, an air baffled and alert, waiting to spring in again and try to make himself and her act as she had planned for them to act. Kneeling before him, she was trying to take off his shoes until he realized what she wanted. He put her hands away and removed the shoes himself, not setting them onto the floor, though. He held to them. She stripped off his stockings, and then she fetched a basin of hot water, fetched it so immediately that anyone but a child would have known that she must have had it ready and waiting all day, probably. He spoke for the first time then.
"I done washed just yesterday," he said.
She didn't answer. She knelt before him while he watched the crown of her head and her hands fumbling a little clumsily about his feet. He didn't try to help her now. He didn't know what she was trying to do, not even when he was sitting with his cold feet in the warm water. He didn't know that that was all, because it felt too good. He was waiting for the rest of it to begin. The part that would not be pleasant, whatever it would be. This had never happened to him before either. Later, she put him to bed. For 2 years almost, he had been dressing and undressing himself, unnoticed and unassisted save by occasional Alice's. He was already too tired to go to sleep at once, and now he was puzzled and hence nervous, waiting until she went out so he could sleep. Then she did not go out. Instead, she drew a chair up to the bed and sat down. There was no fire in the room. It was cold. She had a shawl now about her shoulders, huddled into the shawl, her breath vaporizing as though she were smoking. And he became wide awake now. He was waiting for the part to begin which he would not like, whatever it was that he had done. He didn't know that this was all. This had never happened to him before, either. It began on that night. He believed that it was to go on for the rest of his life. At 17, looking back, he could see now the long series of trivial, clumsy, vain efforts born of frustration and fumbling and dumb instinct. The dishes she would prepare for him in secret and then insist on his accepting and eating them in secret when he did not want them and he knew that McEachern would not care anyway. The times when, like tonight, she would try to get herself between him and the punishment which, deserved or not, just or unjust, was impersonal, both the man and the boy accepting it as a natural and inescapable fact until she, getting in the way, must give it an odor, an attenuation, an aftertaste. Sometimes he thought that he would tell her alone, have her who in her helplessness could neither alter it nor ignore it, know it, and need to hide it from the man whose immediate and predictable reaction to the knowledge would so obliterate it as a factor in their relations that it would never appear again. To say to her in secret payment for the secret dishes which he had not wanted, listen. He says he has nursed a blasphemer and an ingrate. I dare you to tell him what he has nursed. That he has nursed a nigger beneath his own roof, with his own food at his own table. Because she had always been kind to him. The man, the hard, just, ruthless man, merely depended on him to act in a certain way and to receive the as certain reward or punishment, just as he could depend on the man to react in a certain way to his own certain doings and misdoings. It was the woman who, with a woman's affinity and instinct for secrecy, for casting a faint taint of evil about the most trivial and innocent actions. Behind a loose board in the wall of his attic room, she had hidden a small hoard of money in a tin can. The amount was trivial, and it was apparently a secret to no one but her husband, and the boy believed that he would not have cared. But it had never been a secret from him. Even while he was still a child, she would take him with her when, with all the intense and mysterious caution of a playing child, she would creep to the attic and add to the hoard meager and infrequent and terrific nickels and dimes. Fruit of what small chicanery and deceptions, with none anywhere under the sun to say her nay, he did not know. Putting into the can beneath his round, grave eyes coins whose value he did not even recognize. It was she who trusted him, who insisted on trusting him as she insisted on his eating. By conspiracy, in secret, making a secret of the very fact which the act of trusting was supposed to exemplify. It was not the hard work which he hated, nor the punishment and injustice. He was used to that before he ever saw either of them. He expected no less, and so he was neither outraged nor surprised. It was the woman, that soft kindness which he believed himself doomed to be forever victim of, and which he hated worse than he did the hard and ruthless justice of men. "She is trying to make me cry," he thought, lying cold and rigid in his bed, his hands beneath his head and the moonlight falling across his body, hearing the steady murmur of the man's voice as it mounted the stairway on its first heavenward stage. "She was trying to make me cry. Then she thinks that they would have had me." Chapter 8. Moving quietly, he took the rope from its hiding place. One end of it was already prepared for making fast inside the window. Now it took him no time at all to reach the ground and to return. Now, with more than a year of practice, he could mount the rope hand over hand, without once touching the wall of the house, with the shadow-like agility of a cat. Leaning from the window, he let the free end whisper down. In the moonlight, it looked not less frail than a spider skein. Then, with his shoes tied together and strung through his belt behind him, he slid down the rope, passing swift as a shadow across the window where the old people slept. The rope hung directly before the window. He drew it tautly aside, flat against the house, and tied it. Then he went on through the moonlight to the stable and mounted to the loft and took the new suit from its hiding place. It was wrapped in paper, carefully. Before unwrapping it, he felt with his hands about the folds of the paper. "He found it," he thought. "He knows." He said aloud, whispering, "The bastard. The son of a bitch." He dressed in the dark, swiftly. He was already late because he had had to give them time to get to sleep after all the uproar about the heifer. The uproar which the woman had caused by meddling after it was all over. Settled for the night, anyway. The bundle included a white shirt and a tie. He put the tie into his pocket, but he put on the coat so that the white shirt would not be so visible in the moonlight. He descended and emerged from the stable. The new cloth, after his soft, often washed overalls, felt rich and harsh. The house squatted in the moonlight, dark, profound, a little treacherous. It was as though in the moonlight the house had acquired personality. Threatful. Deceptive. He passed it and entered the lane. He took from his pocket a dollar watch. He had bought it 3 days ago with some of the money. But he had never owned a watch before, and so he had forgot to wind it. But he did not need the watch to tell him that he was already late. The lane went straight beneath the moon, bordered on each side by trees whose shadowed branches lay thick and sharp as black paint upon the mild dust. He walked fast, the house now behind him, himself now not visible from the house. The high road passed the lane a short distance ahead. He expected at any moment to see the car rush past, since he had told her that if he were not waiting at the mouth of the lane, he would meet her at the schoolhouse where the dance was being held. But no car passed, and when he reached the high road, he could hear nothing. The road, the night, were empty. Maybe she is already past, he thought. He took out the dead watch again and looked at it. The watch was dead because he had had no chance to wind it. He had been made late by them who had given him no opportunity to wind the watch and so know if he were late or not. Up the dark lane, in the now invisible house, the woman now lay asleep since she had done all she could to make him late. He looked that way, up the lane. He stopped in the act of looking and thinking, mind and body as if on the same switch, believing that he had seen movement among the shadows in the lane. Then he thought that he had not, that it might perhaps have been something in his mind projected like a shadow on a wall. But I hope it is him, he thought. I wish it was him. I wish he would follow me and see me get into the car. I wish he would try to follow us. I wish he would try to stop me. But he could see nothing in the lane. It was empty, intermittent with treacherous shadows. Then he heard, from far down the road toward town, the sound of the car. Looking, he saw presently the glare of the lights. She was a waitress in a small, dingy, back street restaurant in town. Even a casual adult glance could tell that she would never see 30 again. But to Joe, she probably did not look more than 17, too, because of her smallness. She was not only not tall, she was slight, almost childlike. But the adult look saw that the smallness was not due to any natural slenderness, but to some inner corruption of the spirit itself. A slenderness which had never been young, in not one of whose curves anything youthful had ever lived or lingered. Her hair was dark. Her face was prominently boned, always down-looking, as if her head were set so on her neck, a little out of line. Her eyes were like the button eyes of a toy animal, a quality beyond even hardness, without being hard. It was because of her smallness that he ever attempted her. As if her smallness should have or might have protected her from the roving and predatory eyes of most men, leaving his chances better. If she had been a big woman, he would not have dared. He would have thought, it won't be any use. She will already have a fella, a man. It began in the fall, when he was 17. It was a day in the middle of the week. Usually when they came to town, it would be Saturday, and they would bring food with them. Cold dinner in a basket, purchased and kept for that purpose, with the intention of spending the day. This time McEachern came to see a lawyer, with the intention of finishing his business and being home again by dinner time. But it was almost 12 o'clock when he emerged onto the street where Joe waited for him. He came into sight looking at his watch. Then he looked at a municipal clock in the courthouse tower and then at the sun, with an expression of exasperation and outrage. He looked at Joe also with that expression, the open watch in his hand, his eyes cold, fretted. He seemed to be examining and weighing for the first time the boy whom he had raised from childhood. Then he turned. "Come," he said. "It can't be helped now." The town was a railroad division point. Even in midweek, there were many men about the streets. The whole air of the place was masculine, transient. A population even whose husbands were at home only at intervals and on holiday. A population of men who led esoteric lives whose actual scenes were removed and whose intermittent presence was pandered to like that of patrons in a theater. Joe had never before seen the place to which McEachern took him. It was a restaurant on a back street, a narrow, dingy doorway between two dingy windows. He did not know that it was a restaurant at first. There was no sign outside, and he could neither smell nor hear food cooking. What he saw was a long wooden counter lined with backless stools, and a big blonde woman behind a cigar case near the front, and a clump of men at the far end of the counter, not eating, who all turned as one and looked at him and McEachern when they entered, through the smoke of cigarettes. Nobody said anything at all. They just looked at McEachern and Joe as if breathing had stopped with talking, as if even the cigarette smoke had stopped and now drifted aimlessly of its own weight. The men were not in overalls, and they all wore hats, and their faces were all alike. Not young and not old. Not farmers and not townsmen either. They looked like people who had just got off a train and who would be gone tomorrow and who did not have any address. Sitting on two of the backless stools at the counter, McEachern and Joe ate. Joe ate fast because McEachern was eating fast. Beside him, the man, even in the act of eating, seemed to sit in a kind of stiff-backed outrage. The food which McEachern ordered was simple, quickly prepared and quickly eaten. But Joe knew that parsimony had no part in this. Parsimony might have brought them here in preference to another place, but he knew that it was a desire to depart quickly that had chosen the food. As soon as he laid down his knife and fork, McEachern said, "Come," already getting down from his stool. At the cigar counter, McEachern paid the brass-haired woman. There was about her a quality impervious to time, a belligerent and diamond-surfaced respectability. She had not so much as looked at them, even when they entered and even when McEachern gave her money. Still without looking at them, she made the change, correctly and swiftly, sliding the coins onto the glass counter almost before McEachern had offered the bill, herself somehow definite behind the false glitter of the careful hair, the careful face, like a carved lioness guarding a portal, presenting respectability like a shield behind which the clotted and idle and equivocal men could slant their hats and their thwart face-curled cigarettes. McEachern counted his change and they went out into the street. He was looking at Joe again. He said, "I'll have you remember that place." There are places in this world where a man may go, but a boy, a youth of your age, may not. That is one of them. Maybe you should never have gone there. But you must see such so you will know what to avoid and shun. Perhaps it was as well that you saw it with me present to explain and warn you. And the dinner there is cheap. What is the matter with it? Joe said. That is the business of the town and not of yours. You will only mark my words. I'll not have you go there again unless I am with you, which will not be again. We'll bring dinner next time, early or no early. That was what he saw that day while he was eating swiftly beside the unbending and quietly outraged man. The two of them completely isolated at the center of the long counter with at one end of it the brass-haired woman and at the other the group of men, and the waitress with her demure and down-looking face and her big, too big hands setting the plates and cups, her head rising from beyond the counter at about the height of a tall child. Then he and McEachern departed. He did not expect ever to return. It was not that McEachern had forbidden him. He just did not believe that his life would ever again chance there. It was as if he said to himself, "They are not my people. I can see them, but I don't know what they are doing nor why. I can hear them, but I don't know what they are saying nor why nor to whom. I know that there is something about it beside food, eating. But I don't know what, and I never will know." So it passed from the surface of thinking. Now and then, during the next 6 months, he returned to town, but he did not again even see or pass the restaurant. He could have, but he didn't think to. Perhaps he did not need to. More often that he knew, perhaps thinking would have suddenly flowed into a picture, shaping, shaped. The long, barren, somehow equivocal counter with the still, cold-faced, violent-haired woman at one end as though guarding it, and at the other men with inward-leaning heads, smoking steadily, lighting and throwing away their constant cigarettes, and the waitress, the woman not much larger than a child, going back and forth to the kitchen with her arms overladen with dishes, having to pass on each journey within touching distance of the men who leaned with their slanted hats and spoke to her through the cigarette smoke, murmured to her somewhere near mirth or exaltation, and her face musing, demure, downcast, as if she had not heard. "I don't even know what they are saying to her," he thought, thinking, "I don't even know that what they are saying to her is something that men do not say to a passing child," believing, "I do not know yet that in the instant of sleep, the eyelid closing prisons within the eye's self her face demure, pensive, tragic, sad, and young, waiting, colored with all the vague and formless magic of young desire, that already there is something for love to feed upon, that sleeping, I know now why I struck refraining that Negro girl 3 years ago, and that she must know it too, and be proud too, with waiting and pride." So he did not expect to see her again, since love in the young requires as little of hope as of desire to feed upon. Very likely he was as much surprised by his action and what it inferred and revealed as McEachern would have been. It was on Saturday this time, in the spring now. He had turned 18. Again, McEachern had to see the lawyer. But he was prepared now. "I'll be there an hour," he said. "You can walk about and see the town." Again, he looked at Joe, hard, calculating, again a little fretted, like a just man forced to compromise between justice and judgment. "Here," he said. He opened his purse and took a coin from it. It was a dime. "You might try not to throw it away as soon as you can find someone who will take it." "It's a strange thing," he said fretfully, looking at Joe. "But it seems impossible for a man to learn the value of money without first having to learn to waste it. You will be here in 1 hour." He took that coin and went straight to the restaurant. He did not even put the coin into his pocket. He did it without plan or design, almost without volition, as if his feet ordered his action and not his head. He carried the dime clutched hot and small in his palm as a child might. He entered the screen door, clumsily, stumbling a little. The blonde woman behind the cigar case, it was as if she had not moved in the 6 months, not altered one strand of her hard, bright, brass-ridged hair or even her dress, watched him. At the far end of the counter, the group of men with their tilted hats and their cigarettes and their odor of barber shops watched him. The proprietor was among them. He noticed, saw the proprietor for the first time. Like the other men, the proprietor wore a hat and was smoking. He was not a big man, not much bigger than Joe himself, with a cigarette burning in one corner of his mouth as though to be out of the way of talking. From that face, squinted and still behind the curling smoke from the cigarette, which was not touched once with hand until it burned down and was spat out and ground beneath a heel, Joe was to acquire one of his own mannerisms. But not yet. That was to come later, when life had begun to go so fast that accepting would take the place of knowing and believing. Now he just looked at the man who leaned upon the counter from the inward side, in a dirty apron which he wore as a footpad might assume for the moment a false beard. The accepting was to come later, along with the whole sum of entire outrage to credulity. These two people as husband and wife, the establishment as a business for eating, with the successive imported waitresses clumsy with the cheap dishes of simple food as business justified, and himself accepting, taking, during his brief and violent holiday, like a young stallion in a state of unbelieving and ecstatic astonishment, in a hidden pasture of tired and professional mares, himself in turn victim of nameless and unnumbered men. But that was not yet. He went to the counter, clutching the dime. He believed that the men had all stopped talking to watch him, because he could hear nothing now save a vicious frying sound from beyond the kitchen door, thinking, "She's back there. That's why I don't see her." He slid onto a stool. He believed that they were all watching him. He believed that the blonde woman behind the cigar case was looking at him, and the proprietor too, across whose face now the smoke of the cigarette would have become quite still in its lazy vaporing. Then the proprietor spoke a single word. Joe knew that he had not moved nor touched the cigarette. "Bobby," he said. A man's name. It was not thinking. It was too fast, too complete. She's gone. They have got a man in her place. I have wasted the dime, like he said. He believed that he could not leave now, that if he tried to go out, the blonde woman would stop him. He believed that the men at the back knew this and were laughing at him. So he sat quite still on the stool, looking down, the dime clutched in his palm. He did not see the waitress until the two over-large hands appeared upon the counter opposite him and into sight. He could see the figured pattern of her dress and the bib of an apron and the two big knuckled hands lying on the edge of the counter as completely immobile as if they were something she had fetched in from the kitchen. "Coffee and pie," he said. Her voice sounded downcast, quite empty. "Lemon, coconut, chocolate." In proportion to the height from which her voice came, the hands could not be her hands at all. "Yes," Joe said. The hands did not move. The voice did not move. "Lemon, coconut, chocolate. Which kind?" To the others they must have looked quite strange, facing one another across the dark, stained, grease-crusted and friction-smooth counter. They must have looked a little like they were praying. The youth, country-faced, in clean and Spartan clothing, with an awkwardness which invested him with a quality unworldly and innocent. And the woman opposite him, downcast, still, waiting, who because of her smallness partook likewise of that quality of his, of something beyond flesh. Her face was high-boned, gaunt. The flesh was taut across her cheekbones, circled darkly about the eyes. Beneath the lowered lids, her eyes seemed to be without depth, as if they could not even reflect. Her lower jaw seemed too narrow to contain two rows of teeth. "Coconut," Joe said. His mouth said it, because immediately he wanted to unsay it. He had only the dime. He had been holding it too hard to have realized yet that it was only a dime. His hands sweated about it, upon it. He believed that the men were watching him and laughing again. He could not hear them and he did not look at them, but he believed that they were. The hands had gone away. Then they returned, setting a plate and a cup before him. He looked at her now, at her face. "How much is pie?" he said.
"Pie's 10 cents."
She was just standing there before him, beyond the counter, with her big hands again lying on the dark wood, with that quality spent and waiting.